Well, it certainly isn't every Easter in a UU fellowship that we are in a space that is decorated so on point for this holiday. This is one of the perks, I suppose, of meeting in a Methodist church while our own building is expanded and renovated. And an opportunity, I think, to really appreciate the beauty and the wholeness of such an interfaith partnership. A few weeks ago, I met with the minister of the Methodists, Pastor Carey, to gain some insight and some understanding of what Easter means to her and to her congregation, and to orient me to the art and the iconography in this sanctuary. Now, the art in here may not be your own cup of tea, and maybe you're someone who, on most Sundays, will overlook them and focus instead on our own chalice and the altar that we bring into this space. And that is absolutely fine and appropriate. But on this high holy day of Christianity, I do want to call our attention to the iconography in this room. Not because I think we have to agree with it or even understand it fully, but at the very least, to recognize it, to see it, and perhaps appreciate it for what it means to our hosts, if not to us. So, I begin actually with the stained glass on either side. On the west, or the east side, you have primarily some trees and beautiful nature scenes, but there's circles in the bottom you may not be able to see that have what I would call a highlight reel of scenes from the Bible. So we start with creation, we have the Garden of Eden, Noah's Ark, and so on. And then we get into New Testament, gospel narratives, and then the gospel's story is continued on the west side. And then above, the crests on these stained glass are actually, I did not know this, but these are for the apostles. There's 12 of them, so there's one for each apostle. The symbolism is based on how that apostle died. And then you'll also notice the completely blacked out shield on the west side, which is for Judas, the betrayer, of course. And then behind me, we of course have the cross adorned with white cloth for Easter. And above and behind that, what I, obviously very uninitiated in Christianity, I thought this was some kind of Colorado Rocky Mountain scene. Also being newly initiated to Colorado. This is of course the tomb of Jesus with the stone rolled away, revealing it to be empty. And then there are also a few paintings and other pieces around, including behind you all a very common portrait of Jesus up there, which I get to look at all the time, which is great, and which I certainly noticed, and I think many of you, I've heard, have noticed when you look at that, you might think, well, that is a fairly white Jesus for someone who is supposed to live in first century Palestine, which is more or less what Pastor Carey said when we got to that point in our tour. So let that remind us that we may always have a little more in common with our mainline Christian neighbors than we may assume at first. Because it would be easy to see that painting and the other stained glass and iconography in here and think, man, these people are serious about this and about this guy. And I maybe get the sense that their beliefs are a little more literal or conservative than mine are or would be if I were Christian. And of course, they are serious, just as we are about our own faith and our personal convictions. But we have to be cautious about what we can assume about a person or their faith from merely the iconography in their sacred space. For one, part of our perception is very comparative, right? Unitarian Universalist sanctuaries, like our own that's being renovated, are often more devoid of iconography. The fellowship has our chalice, which we've brought here, and we have beautiful stained glass in what will be our fellowship hall, but that glass is more suggestive of themes and ideas than referencing a very specific story the same way these stained glass here are. So there's a lot more iconography and art here than you may be used to, if you spend a lot of time in our previous space. But for those of you who are familiar with Catholicism in one way or another, you know that from that tradition's perspective, this is a pretty barren and sparse sanctuary. So it's all relative. And part of what forms our UU aesthetic, well, one part is our heritage and our history, deriving from the Puritans in New England, who basically rejected any kind of adornment and wanted very simple architecture and decoration. But the other main influence in our worship spaces is our non-creedalism, or pluralism. We Unitarian Universalists partake of various stories and don't all participate in a single shared narrative or mythos. This usually means that UU spaces either have no specific icons, other than the chalice for UUism, or they might depict various symbols from various religions and ethical traditions. So we have to recognize where we're coming from and what assumptions we bring, and try to have an open mind when it comes to learning about another faith or other people based simply on their sacred space. We're much more likely to get an accurate sense of their beliefs from a real conversation with one of the Methodists, for instance, than from speculating about it as we gaze upon their art. Which again is why I met with Pastor Carey. I myself was born and raised UU, and Easter was never a very big part of church life for me. So I was eager to learn from somebody else's direct perspective. To give me context for Easter, Pastor Carey walked me through the whole arc of the liturgical season, beginning with Ash Wednesday, going through Lent, and Holy Week up to this morning. So here's my rough and quick understanding of the outline based on that conversation. Lent is a time designed to mirror Jesus' time in the wilderness. It is a time of intentional self-examination and preparation. So it begins on Ash Wednesday, which includes the ash cross on the forehead, a ritual reminder that we humans are mortal. Fast forward to a week before Easter, we have Palm Sunday, which recognizes Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem. As TC talked about earlier, with Jesus entering from one side and a Roman legion on the other side of the city, his followers were expecting and perhaps hoping for a big military showdown, which they did not get. Later that week, on Maundy Thursday, Jesus takes off his robes, a metaphor of his divinity, and he washes the feet of his friends. This is the job of the lowest servant, an example of servant leadership. And so this is often remembered with a Maundy Thursday service where the people wash the feet of others, which, regardless of one's connection to this particular story or theology, that is a powerful and intimate experience of service. On Good Friday, Jesus is arrested, tortured, and crucified. A Good Friday service often involves the tenebrae, the service of darkness, a service of lamentation, of really recognizing and experiencing the low point of the arc in this story and the reality of suffering and pain in our world. 3 days later, if you count Good Friday as the first day, we have Easter Sunday, when the tomb is found empty by Mary and the women in one gospel and by John in another. This is an experience of mystery and miracle, and it's unclear at first what it means. In Mark, the women are terrified and they say nothing. This gospel thus poses the question to the audience, what are you going to do now that you have heard? John's gospel is a little more direct and asks the audience to mourn, to be joyful, and then to go and tell what happened. But what is the message? What does this story mean? Pastor Carey shared with me that in her studies there are at least 26 different atonement theories, different theologies to explain what happened on the cross and why it's important. But none of them are entirely satisfactory to her, which sounds fairly UU to me. Or rather that You use "don't corner the market" on skepticism and thoughtfulness, but I digress. For Pastor Carey, rather than ascribing to any one theory of atonement, she looks to Scripture. For her, it's all about the end of Romans 8. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will hardship or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. And here is the key part. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God. Death is both the great metaphor for separation and the ultimate separator itself. Jesus overcomes death. He rises to prove to humanity that we are loved even beyond death. That the thing that separates us does not actually separate us from one another. There is no separation, only the simple turning of a page from life to whatever comes next. Ultimate reality is being one with God, and that is not changeable. Pastor Carey said that that is what they celebrate on Easter, the idea that death has no real power here. So Jesus died to prove something to humans as a demonstration of the truth of ultimate reality, the truth at the core of the Christian message. So for Pastor Carey, at least, it is not that Jesus' death changes God's mind about the fate of humanity. You may recall a similar point I made a few Sundays ago when I talked about early Unitarianism and Universalism. It seems that Pastor Carey would be in agreement with Unitarian founder William Ellery Channing when he says, "The idea, which is conveyed to common minds by the popular system, that Christ's death has an influence in making God placable or merciful, in awakening his kindness towards men, we reject with strong disapprobation." In this interpretation, then, a Unitarian and a Universalist version of Easter is one where salvation is available to all, and it is a fully human Jesus who dies and rises in some form. Whether in the miracle is a suspension of physics and a true resurrection, whether it is the power of a story to change people's lives, or the miracle that Jesus died as a human and rose as a community of faith and values. Each of these kinds of resurrections demonstrate the possibility and promise of resurrection, of a spring after the winter, of barley bending and rising, of sorrows transformed into song. So that's what I'm receiving from Easter this year. The biblical narrative is not my story, really. It does not speak to me directly. I am not steeped in its culture, in its metaphors. But delving into Easter as I did this year, I found myself nodding along, recognizing the truth behind Easter, just like recognizing the humanity behind another person's eyes. Even as I may look and live and believe very differently from another person, I recognize the sacred within them as that same sacred within myself. I recognize the message of life over death, of love over hate, of hope over despair, this message articulated in a language I will never really be fluent in, but a language that I understand a little bit better now, having had a conversation and getting to know another person a little bit better. And maybe that's another version of this Easter message, that no matter how separate or how different we may be from one another, love, compassion, human connection, curiosity, these can always overcome whatever distance or separation may be between us. that love will help us come to know one another. To be fair, it was pretty easy between Pastor Carey and myself. We have similar professions, similar educations, and our two traditions, UUism and liberal Methodism, really aren't that far apart in the grand scheme of religions, if you create a continuum or a matrix. But I do think that the principle stands. You yourself may have a neighbor, or a family member, or an old friend, who has a very different outlook on religion, on politics, on the matters that we value the most. And the outlooks may well be incompatible. There may be real distance, real separation there. But deeper than that incompatibility, and deeper than the distance, deeper than the separation between you, is the potential for connection. For, if not understanding, conversation. If not respect, curiosity. And it is this potential that I think Unitarian Universalism is grounded in. We do not come together under one roof because we share the same exact story. In fact, because of the opposite, we come together because we are convinced that having community and connections among our different stories and between them makes us better people and helps us practice living in diversity, which we try to live out into the world as much as we do inside our congregation. We don't do it perfectly, and it is not always easy, and it's not always without pain and suffering. We would do well to not gloss over this fact. But whatever our own story, however we understand the underlying truth behind all stories and all ways of understanding this vast universe of ours, may we always remember the deep interconnectedness of all life, the love and hope at the center of reality, and the verdant possibilities that arise when we reach out to understand and to know one another.